No book in all the world has ever changed humanity like the Bible. No book in all the world has ever changed people for the better, both Old and New Testament times. From patriarchal law, when the light of God came among the prophets, as Moses wrote it, beginning in Genesis through Deuteronomy, but long before Moses was ever born, God sent such men like Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and even Joseph down in Egypt, and it made the world a better place. And as you look, however, at the history of men as it goes through the Old Testament and even into the New Testament to the greatest man ever walked the earth, Jesus Christ, there has always been a place that women held in God's high esteem. From both the Old Testament and particularly in the first century, women were pretty much by the world classed as tools. As a matter of fact, when I was doing some research in my family genealogy, when you go back and you study, you know, grandparents and then what they have, the record of their inheritances and so forth, one of the things I learned about a marriage license is that the reason we have marriage licenses, guys, is because women are classed as property. You think about that a minute. That's probably not what you women wanted to hear today on a Mother's Day, right? Class is property. As I was looking back at my genealogy, it basically gave my great-great-grandfather's name, and it said wife, children, house, land, cattle. See, it didn't give the names of anybody. It just gave the man's name. And then it gave what he possessed after that. This book has done more to elevate womankind than ever has there been a book in this world. By the way, are you thankful you are not under the realm of Islam, ladies, in view of what you know that this book teaches of womanhood? There's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor free, male nor female, bond or free. You're all one in Christ Jesus. Galatians 3, verse 28. God made them male and female and created the first home. And yes, the Bible does say the woman being deceived was in the transgression, and Adam succumbed to what Eve asked of him to do. Evidently, she persuaded him to eat of that, according to Genesis chapter 3. It says, because you did hearken unto the voice of thy wife and did eat. She said something to him. The Bible doesn't record what she said. I want to talk today in the book of Judges about some very powerful women in very troubling times. When you go back to Genesis, you'll find great women. You'll find, no doubt, Noah's wife was a great woman. Would you not say that? Because there were only 8 souls on the ark. And by the way, 4 of those were women. Half men, half women. Sarah. You go all the way down through the history of time and you find Jochebed, Moses' mother. And the history of womankind is that there were some very, very powerful women. By the way, powerful in influence, not necessarily for the good. I think you and I would have to say that Jezebel would rank up there with a powerful woman, but not for the good. I think you and I from the New Testament would have to say that Herodias had a power over Herod that cost John the Baptist his head. That not all women that are powerful are necessarily good women that are powerful. But real, real powerful women in the eyes of God, and very strong women, very women that to be looked up to, are not the women in the easy times. It's the women in the tough ones. It's when you find out what you're made of. If thou faint in the day of adversity, thy strength is small, Proverbs 24, verse 10 says. Now in Judges 17, verses 1 to 6, you have an example of a woman who is not named. Her son is named. His name is Micah. And there is a curse that this woman has placed upon 10,000 shekels of silver. Somebody took it. And she has pronounced a curse upon whoever it was that stole it. I'll let you read those verses on your own. I'm just sort of put it in, you know, in a sort of a simplified form here. Her son Micah actually took it. and told his mother, "I'm the one that took it." And then she turns right around and says, "Blessed be thou of the Lord." I dedicated this money, okay, to the Lord, by the way, to make a teraphim, to make an image, a molded image. She took 200 shekels of it, or 2,000 shekels of it, took it to the founder, means the guy that melts this. He pours it down into a mold and makes it into a graven and a molten image. First, it was a molten image, and then evidently carved on it. That's what engraved means, to give the details of the fixtures of whatever that image was to look like. So what you have then is she, idolatrous at heart, turns around and pronounces a curse upon the thief that took away her money, that she was going to dedicate to make a god for her son. And her son stole the money. And by the way, once she gets the money back, she still goes on with her plans. Why? Because she's still idolatrous in heart. Though she will use the word Jehovah, the word Lord. It's like I'm going to mix one religion with another religion and it's going to work out fine. And then her son Micah, after the image was made, made him a house, an ephod, appointed one of his own sons. By the way, you got to keep this in the family, right? If it's your home religion. Appointed one of his own sons to be priest in the house. By the way, you got to have a priesthood, right? You got to have a god and a place to worship and a priest. And idolatry had all of that. And that woman became a symbol of what it says in verse 6, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes." You know, have it your way. Church of your choice, God of your approval. Do whatever you please. Whatever makes you happy, obviously, is going to make God happy. So these are tough times. Religions run amok. By the way, how many generations did it take from Joshua before you end up in a situation like this? One. Just one. How many of you in this room are of a generation that remembers when the gospel was preached, it wasn't anything for people to be baptized in a week, to have double-digit baptisms in a week? And gospel meetings then went on protracted. They became two-week gospel meetings. What started out as one ended up as two. By the way, you didn't sit in a fine, comfortable building on padded pews. You were out in tents or brush arbors down by some stream or creek. Same gospel message was preached. Same Bible was quoted. Responses were right and left. Congregations were started in communities where there was no congregation. Yesterday, I was up at East Hill in Pulaski, Tennessee, and I was eating lunch with a man by the name of B.J. Clark. B.J. actually is the director of Memphis School of Preaching now in Memphis. B.J. and I have been friends for a good long while. He said he ran across a statement recently. He says, "That which was born in caves dies in cathedrals." He said, he mentioned that to me. I said, "B.J., I've known that for a long, long time. That goes back to church history." He said, "Well, I just learned that phrase the other day. I thought that was pretty unique. That which is born in caves, what started in a cave to hide because you feared for your life, but you're going to preach this gospel in a cave, ultimately it dies in cathedrals." In religious church history, what that was, what that statement was coined was the history of what happened in a grassroots level, particularly in Europe and really, truly in England. What started because of religious persecution, that people would die for their faith, ultimately, people didn't have to die for their faith because the faith became popular. It became accepted. You have freedom of religion, you have freedom of expression, you have freedom to assemble, you have freedom to believe whatever you want. And so the next thing you know, because people were not afraid now to go assemble, now you got to build big buildings. And by the way, what kind of buildings do you build? You build cathedrals. And what happens in cathedrals? Everyone becomes complacent, passive. And what happens now as you go to Europe, Go to a worship service in Europe, walk into a cathedral on the first day of the week, see how many people you see sitting there. It's interesting. I was told in England, when I was over there in a campaign, there's only three times in your life, if you're an Anglican, you even have to show up at the church building. Three times in your life. By the way, that's not Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter. Three times in your life. The day you're born, in which you are christened, the day you get married in the church building, the day they have your funeral. And that's considered faithful as an Anglican. You're a faithful Anglican, I was told. This is 1981. If you were christened in the church building, if you got married in the building, and if they had your funeral in the building. By the way, only one of them you had to actually choose, right? Because birth and death, you didn't have any choice in that unless you obviously made the death arrangements to have it in the building. But you are a faithful Anglican church member if you darken the door three times in your life. And by the way, and none of them technically had to do anything with the worship service on the first day of the week. They called it hatch'em, match'em, and dispatch'em. That's how that was worded. Hatch'em, match'em, dispatch'em. So what do the preachers do over there on Sundays if nobody shows up at the building, because all you got to do is it when you're christened and when you're married and when your funeral is? It said the preachers over there write sermon outline books. And the parishioners, by the way, that's what they call their members, the parishioners buy the preacher's sermon outline books so that they can read the sermons at their leisure when they need encouragement. And then they have their prayer book by which they have the prayers that are written in there so that they can read the prayers out loud so that they can have something to pray by. Was no king in Israel ever man did what was right in his own eyes. Make me a religion of convenience where I don't have to show up. Put it in book form, I might buy the book. I'll use it when it's convenient for me. In these tough times when every man did what was right in his own eyes, I want to mention to you three women. Because here's the breakdown of that woman in Judges 17. Number one, here's her words. Cursed be the one. She placed a curse on the one that stole the money. By the way, when her son turns right around and tells her he stole the money, what does she say? Blessed art thou in the Lord. How many of you have ever heard somebody use words that they don't really mean? Here's a woman who's mad somebody stole this money. And then when she found out, oh, it's one of my family, I'll change my tune. You ever known of anybody to criticize somebody else's kids, but they wouldn't do that to their own child? You're looking at it in Judges 17. If I was that parent, I'd tell you what I'd do with that child. Well, you need to be looking at your child, because your child's doing the same thing you're criticizing that parent for not disciplining your child. Well, you don't quit preaching, gone to meddling. You mind your own business. It's not your family. See, that woman's that way in Judges 17. Her words don't mean anything. Whoever it is that stole the money, cursed be on them. Mama, I stole the money. Blessed art you, child. So her words don't mean anything. Next thing, what about her ways? Is she fickle? Where is her heart? She uses the word Lord. I have dedicated this to the Lord, Jehovah. And now what's she going to turn around and use that silver for? Jehovah? Idolatry is in the heart, and I'm going to show you what my real religion is. And then you turn around, and she developed her son's own religion. Wow, how convenient is that? You don't have to go to the idolatrous temple around here in the closest town, or even in your town. Here, build you a house. We'll put your God inside your house. By the way, get one of my grandsons to be the priest. And by the way, we can just have a house church. Y'all ever heard of a house church? Here is the Old Testament illustration of a house church. Church as you want it. As you want it. By the way, if you worship in your own house, how do you forsake the assembling of yourselves together? How many of you have ever heard the expression, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them? As though here I am and my wife is in the same house, and we don't go to church, we worship here in our house. Here's me and here's my wife, and where two or three are gathered together in my... How do you ever forsake the assembly then? By the way, I pointed that out to a man that made that observation. By the way, where two or three are gathered together in my name has nothing to do with worship services on the first day of the week, according to Matthew 18. You know what that has reference to? You know what that has reference to, right? If your brother have aught against you, go to your brother. If your brother hear you, you have gained your brother. If you hear him not, take two or three with you. If you hear not two or three, then you tell it to the church. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of you. The context of that has nothing to do with the first day of the week assembly. It has to do with reaching out to try to get a brother who sinned to be restored to his first love. You've taken two or three with you, and therefore, as my people are going to this man's house to help him straighten his life out, so am I with all of you in the process. By the way, isn't the church the spiritual body of Jesus Christ? And the Bible teaches, which is his body, the church, the fullness of him that fills all in all? Absolutely it is. Church isn't this building. The church are the people sitting in these pews right here. This is what's important to the Lord. It's going to burn this building up, by the way, in the end of time if the tornado don't get it again, right? Building's just a building. The church are the people. So what are you looking at here? We're going to have my own church. We're going to have my own worship. We're going to have my own God, my own priesthood, my own place to worship. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. It's tough. It's tough to follow the will of God in a world like that, isn't it? Then all of a sudden you see these homes. A woman by the name of Jael, we're going to talk about this lady, found in Judges chapters 5 and 6, 4 and 5 actually, chapter 4 of the history, chapter 5, a song of Deborah. She was a judge, one of the judges, actually the only female judge there was at that day. Then we're going to talk about Ruth. That was in the days of the judges, according to Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. And then 1 Samuel. Samuel was the last judge of the judges. And his mother's name was Hannah. But first of all, probably the least likely of the three on this wall right here is the first one, Jael. Jael married a man by the name of Eber, H-E-B-E-R. He was a Kenite. Kenite was a descendant of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, the Midianite. Midianites were nomads. They lived in tents and they traveled up and down wherever, you know, the seasons were for their sheep and their herds and so forth to graze. They moved from place to place because if you overgraze, you lose your flocks, you lose your herds. So you move from place to place according to the seasons. Higher elevation, lower elevation, wherever you need to go. So she's married to a man who's a herdsman, and they're living in a tent. They're living in the land of Israel. They're living up in Galilee. And there's a war that broke out in Galilee. The king of Canaan, Jabin, J-A-B-I-N, has a captain of his army named Sisera, very strong man. He has thousands of chariots, iron chariots. He's a warrior. And here's a particular man in Israel. His name is Balak. And he is goes to Deborah. Or Barak, excuse me, not Balak. Barak. And he goes to Deborah, and Deborah basically tells him to go up and to fight around Mount Tabor, high mountain peak in the middle of the valley of Jezreel. He tells Deborah that basically he will not go unless she goes. By the way, she's not from that area. She's from a different region. And she says, I will go with you, but due to the fact that this is your suggestion and this is what you want to do, the victory will not come as honor to you. It will be given into the hands of a woman. By the way, ouch, right, men? Ouch. The credit is going to go to a woman. by the way. And she's not even a warrior. She's not even a judge. Even worse, she's not even an Israelite. Jael is not an Israelite. Jael is married to a Midianite, the father-in-law of Moses, who's a nomad. He just lives in that land. He's a foreigner. He's a sojourner. War breaks out around Mount Tabor. Israel is prevailing, obviously, based upon the fact that the war is of God. The victory is going to come from God. The battle's the Lord's. Sisera gets out of his chariot and runs on foot because he's being overrun. His army's being overrun. He's actually trying to hide. He ends up in the camp of Eber. And Eber's not there, but Jael is in the tent. Now, according to the record of Judges chapter 4, there was an alliance, a friendly, peaceable alliance between the king of Canaan and Sisera and Eber. They were not at war with one another. It is the Canaanites against the Israelites. We don't fight the Midianites, we fight the Israelites. So Sisera runs to the tent of Eber, and Jael's there. How many of you have ever heard of political alliances in this world? Does the United States of America have political alliances with other countries in this world? Do we lean on the political alliances in other parts of the world while we're here in the United States of America? Absolutely. All over this planet, right? Well, Eber is the political alliance of the king of Canaan, Jabin. Now, you would think the man's wife would side with her husband. Look, we're friends of them. We're not friends of the Israelites. We just happen to be in the Israelite land. So, you know, we got to choose sides here. Well, the battle goes against Canaan. The battle goes against Sisera. Sisera walks inside the tent and basically tells Jael, I need to be hidden. And by the way, he also tells her, I'm thirsty. He asks for water. She gives him milk to drink. The Bible says he was weary, tired. By the way, he's running for his life and he's hiding now for his life. She puts a mantle over him. Evidently, it's a pretty good piece of cloth by which then to cover him should anybody happen to show up in the camp and show up in that tent. He tells her that if anybody shows up and asks, is there a man there, you are to tell him no. Tell him no. By the way, lie to save my hide. The Israelites are obviously still pursuing these Canaanites, the army of Jabin, the army actually of Sisera. The captain now is hiding in retreat. The text of Scripture says Jael took a tent stake. By the way, she lives in a tent. And in her right hand, she took a hammer. Sisera is fast asleep because he's weary. And by the way, she's filled him up with a big glass of milk. Y'all ever had milk before you go to bed? He had a big glass of milk and he laid down. And she takes in her left hand a tent stake and drives it through his temple and fastens his head to the ground. Well, honey, what in the world have you done? Word's going to get back to the king of Canaan, of which we are at peace with these people. We are friends with these people. That you have done this to the captain of this man's army. So not by the hand of Barak did the captain of the army die. Not by the hand of Deborah either, but by the hand of a woman. Turn now to Judges 5, verses 24 to 27. Here is the song that was sung. Song of Deborah. It says, chapter 5 and verse 1, sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Ahinoam, on that day. And there is a line in this song that praises this woman. Verse 24, blessed above women. Oh, wait a minute. Have you ever seen words like that before in the New Testament? Blessed art thou above women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Do Roman Catholics know that line? You ever heard of the word magnificat? In Roman Catholic faith, that is the song of Mary from Luke 2. It is sung many, many times in the Roman Catholic Church, elevating Mary actually to equal Jesus Christ himself. Because you pray not only through Christ, you also pray through Mary according to that religion. This woman in the song of Deborah and Barak is being elevated that way. Blessed above women shall Jael, the wife of Eber the Kenite, be. Blessed shall she be above women in the tent. Above all women who are wives of men who are tent dwellers in Midian. Jael will go down in history as being one of the greatest women in the Israelite nation. And she's not even an Israelite. She's not even an Israelite, folks. Let me ask you a question. Is there any woman in here who would dare, I'm not talking about getting mad enough to do it, who would even dare take a tent stake and a hammer and drive one through a man's head? Can you see yourself ever bringing yourself to that point? I said something like that one time to a person, and they said, you know, I believe that'd be tough for me to do. And by the way, you better make that first shot good, right? Because you're fixing to wake him up, are you not, if you miss? What if she swung and missed the nail and hit the ground and woke him up and he realized what she's trying to do? You better make that first blow good. And by the way, she did. Straight through the head, pinned his head to the ground. I ask you a question. Is that a powerful woman? Judges 5 says she is. The next verse says, he asked water, she gave him milk. She brought forth butter in a lordly dish. She put her hand to the nail and her right hand to the hammer's workman's hammer. And with a hammer, she smote Sisera. She smote off his head when she had pierced and stricken through his temple. Here's the chorus, verse 27. At her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay down. At her feet he bowed, he fell, where he bowed, there he fell dead. Is this woman a warrior? This woman a king? No, there is no king in Israel. So what's this woman, what's she about? This man Sisera is to die. I know there's political alliances between my family and this man and his king, but this man is the enemy. Evidently, Jael didn't have the same conviction about the Canaanites that her husband did. Her conviction was different. And instead of being the enemy of God and God's people, she became an ally to God and God's people. That wasn't popular. Trust me, what she did was not popular. And it was hard. And she did it anyway. And God put that in the Old Testament, and you and I have got an Old Testament, and we're studying it in May the 12th, 2018. That woman's name goes down in history, doesn't it? Let's go to another great, powerful woman. Her name is Ruth. Ruth chapter 1, 16 and 17. When her husband's dead, God's visited his people. Naomi's going back to her homeland. She tells her two daughter-in-laws, go back to your people. Should I have sons and they should arise to be your husbands? You'd be so old, that would not happen. Go back to your own people and find husbands. Orpha kissed her mother-in-law and returned. Ruth says, entreat me not to leave thee, nor to return from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go. Whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people, not the Moabite people, thy people, Israel, will be my people. And thy God, Jehovah, not Molech, thy God, is now my God. And where you lodge, I will be lodged. And where you are buried, there I will be buried. By the way, is that pretty strong commitment in words? And you read the rest of the book of Ruth, and did she follow through with it? By the way, she was not all that popular among everybody in Israel. In chapter 4 of the book of Ruth, and I'm giving a brief synopsis here. In chapter 4, there was a nearer kinsman than Boaz, right? And Boaz knew that. And when he went to the gate by which for her to raise up seed to her dead husband, he said, I cannot, it will mar my inheritance. Why? She's a Moabite, I don't want her. See, Ruth was not the most popular person in that town. Boaz says, then let me redeem it, for I will. And he gave him his shoe, which by the way was a sign and also an insult with a man walking around with one shoe on. And therefore then Boaz raised up seed to Ruth's first husband. And in that seed line, if you'll follow it on down, it says they begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse. Jesse begat David the king. In David's genealogical line, he could go back through Israel for a little while. By the way, he got Moabite blood in his veins. I'll tell you another kind of blood he's got in his veins. Boaz's mother was Rahab, who married Salmon, the Israelite that came out of Egypt. Rahab was a harlot and a Canaanite from Jericho. So David's bloodline has got Canaanite blood and Moabite blood. He's a mixed blood. I wonder what a scribe and a Pharisee would think about that. You're not even pure-blooded. By the way, how many of you ever heard of Harry Potter? You got Hermione here in the Harry Potter series. What's her problem with some of these true blue bloods over at Hogwarts? What's her problem? She's a mudblood. What does that mean? You're mixed blood. You're not really one of us. Right. I'll show you. I don't want to be one of you. And was she different? Did it matter? And Ruth shines, does she not? Do you know what the Hebrew word Ruth really means? Ruth. We got a granddaughter's middle name's Ruth. Lily Ruth Clark. They were going to call her something else, and I didn't like that middle name. It wasn't my idea that they changed it anyway. And when they said Ruth, I said, that's a good, strong name. The Hebrew word, Ruth, means friend, female friend. Was this woman a friend of God, Ruth? By the way, is she not popular? Except in certain circles. Later on, she will become famous in Israel. She is the great, great grandmother of the one after God's own heart. Then you come to Hannah. When we found out that we were going to have a daughter, this is the name I picked out. I told Pam, this is what we're going to call her. First name's Bethany. Last name, middle name, Hannah. We call her Hannah. Hannah in Hebrew is from the word Hina, the Hebrew word for grace, the grace of God. Hina. Here's a woman married to a man who's already got another wife, and that wife is having children right and left by this husband of hers, and she's barren. And one day they go up to Shiloh, and there's a wicked, wicked high priest there who's also the judge. His name is Eli, and he's got two of the wickedest boys you'd ever want to raise. And by the way, part of their wickedness was their daddy's problem. When they did evil, he restrained them not. You ever heard of a permissive parent to allow your children to do whatever they want to do? Oh, I don't want to hurt his attitude. It might mess up his psyche. Yeah, Dr. Spock personified. Don't tell him no. Don't spank him. You're going to end up with Hophni and Phinehas is what you're going to end up with. See, whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning. This is Old Testament learning here. Hannah goes and prays. She does not say anything out of her mouth vocally, but she's moving her lips while she's praying. Eli thinks she's drunk, and he basically rebukes her. I am not drunk. I am a woman of sorrowful spirit, and I have poured out my soul to the Lord. That's what prayer is. Eli then basically blesses her for basically saying that. What does she ask for? Lord, if you will give me a child, if you'll give me a son, I make a vow. I will give him back to you. It's big words, isn't it? All I need is, by the way, she had more children than Samuel, if you go back and read the history of your Bible. She had more children than Samuel. How many of you mothers in this room can imagine having a child and all of a sudden you made a promise because you gave me this child, I will give him to the church. I'll let him live with Jimmy and Pam Clark for the rest of his life so that they can train him to do church work. Can you imagine giving up your child so that Pam Clark and I could raise your child? Or anybody for that matter in the church? And by the way, he's going to grow up that way. And by the way, and I would hope our family would be a whole lot different than growing up in Eli's house with Hophni and Phinehas as brothers, sort of, you know, adopted foster brothers here. But when Hannah made a promise, she made a promise, right? And when Samuel became weaned, she took him up to Shiloh, and there Samuel lived all those days as a young boy. And later on, because God is with him, he becomes a prophet. He runs a circuit. Ramah, Jericho, Bethel. And he starts a school called the School of the Prophets. The sons of the prophets are the names of the students. And he's training these people what? We have lived in tough times and our nation has gone away from God. And I'm going to start a school to train you how to lead singing and how to pray and how to preach so that we can turn this nation back to God. And that was what Samuel did. Listen, it all came from the prayer of a mother. It all came from a woman who was vexed day by day by her rival wife, or his rival wife. Yet here is a woman who trusted in God and created one of the most beautiful home environments in an awful time in Israelite history. Now, what do all these women have in common? Number one, they've all got guts. They all got courage. It goes without saying, Jael's got courage, don't she? But what about Ruth? Thy God will be my God. Your people will be. What if my people don't like you? Your people will still be my people. Where you lodge, that's where I lodge. Where you're buried, that's where I'll be buried. That takes courage to give up your homeland, what you were familiar with all your life. It took courage in order for Hannah to be able to do what she did. The idea, I've got to give my son up now. Another thing you'll find about, they all had conviction. Jael did not ask her husband, what do you think I ought to do, Eber? She knew what needed to be done. She did it. She knew where her conviction lied, regardless of what her husband thought. Will we serve God rather than men? Ask Jael what her answer is. Ask Ruth, will we serve God rather than men? My sister-in-law has gone back to my nation, and gone back to my old gods. Your people are now my people, and your gods are my God. What about Hannah? I have poured out my soul to the Lord. I have nowhere to go but God. Commitment. When a person says they're going to do something and don't do it, is that commitment? How do you find out what a person really believes when you're put to the test, right? JL, do you believe in God and God's people? Absolutely. All right, you're going to be given a chance to prove that. Let's see if you do it. Bam! Sisera's dead. Is that commitment, folks? Let me ask you a question. What did Jabin, the king of Canaan, think about a woman driving a tent stake through his captain's head and killing him? You think there's a bounty on her head? You think there's other folks that want to kill her for having assassinated this captain of his? Matters not what men think. It only matters what God thinks. What about Ruth? Did she do what she said she'd do in chapter 1? She's gleaning in Boaz's field. In chapter 3, she's there at that campsite. In chapter 4, does she go ahead and marry Boaz? By the way, is she renowned in Israel because of her commitment? What about Hannah? Lord, I told you if you gave me a child, I'd give him back to you. Here he is. And every year she visited him. Mother going every year to go see her boy at Shiloh. Watching him grow up in tough times. To me, it's sort of amazing that Samuel turned out the way he did. Is it amazing to you? Having to be raised under the influence of an Eli and a Hophni and a Phinehas. What does that just go to show? Young folks, it goes to show is you can have bad influences around you and you can still turn out good. Because all three of the names we've talked about had bad influences around them growing up. And they all turned out good. So male, female, young or old, be a powerful person in tough times. And we didn't even discuss Jesus Christ. How tough did he have to be to leave heaven to come down here? Would that take courage, knowing what he's about to have to face to do that? Did it take conviction on his part to follow through with what he was believing in? And by the way, did he show any commitment to humanity while he said, I am come to do thy will, O God? And did he do it? Folks, he prayed 3 times if it were possible to change that plan. Did he not? If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. I believe he meant it. But I believe he also meant it. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. That's commitment. It's not what I want to do, it's what's right in my own eyes. It's what's right in your eyes that I want to do. And there are some great men of the Bible who lived that life and died in faith. Folks, there were some great women in the Bible who lived that life and died in faith too. And that's how you want to leave this world. The Kenny Chaney is going to lead us in a song of encouragement. If you're subject to heaven's invitation to be baptized into Christ, come back to your first love. Won't you then come as we stand.
saying.